On Sunday, February 25th, 96 public broadcasting service affiliates, including 9 in the nation's largest 24 television markets, would not show the PBS documentary Paul Jacobs and the Nuclear Gang. Now, this expose was on the effects of low-level radiation and the attempts of the federal government to suppress this information. Stations serving areas that are faced with the radiation controversy in particular backed out of showing the program. Heavy pressure on the local PBS stations came from the Atomic Industrial Forum, which is a nuclear industry trade association, and that's seen as perhaps a chief cause for the blackout and the censorship. That means we probably wouldn't be able to get any programs of ours on PBS, Alternative Views News Magazine.
Welcome to Alternative Views. There were two important elections in recent days in England and its former colony, Rhodesia. As usual, the U.S. media focused solely on personalities and neglected to analyze the issues, the history behind the elections, and their significance. We will have two reports tonight on these elections. First, we'll have a report on the election in England, discussing Margaret Thatcher, the Conservative candidate who apparently won the election, and her program that was neglected to really be discussed by the American media. And we'll also have a taped report with Peter Bell, a professor of economics, on the current state in England, what's going on in English society, that will give you background to the election and understanding of what's really happening in England. We'll also have a report on the election in Rhodesia, its background in history, with Ezelian Agban, who will provide an interpretation of the results of the Rhodesian election. Frank, do you have some news stories to begin?
Oh, yes, we have tons of news stories. I guess it's a matter of selecting just which one will go first. Well, why don't we take this one? We've been reporting economic news and the effects of inflation on everybody recently. In the year of 1973 to 78, the average weekly earnings rose 49%, but consumer prices rose 56%, and dividends 100%. So the higher prices have not only wiped out all the workers' hard-earned gains, but they've actually lost about 5% of the purchasing power. But on the other hand, the purchasing power of stockholders' dividends has jumped up about 40%. Although corporations paid out nearly $50 billion in dividends last year, that represented only about 42% of their after-tax profits. Al, do you have any comments on any of that? Does that stack up with most of the stuff that you've seen and read?
Well, if you remember last week, Frank, we did my annual inflation update, and we talked about the price of necessities increasing at a much faster rate than the price of luxuries. Even though personal income went up last month 1%, it was more than wiped out by inflation. But the important thing to note, again, is that top 20% of the population earns almost half of all national income. And these are the people who can afford tax lawyers and accountants, and they're sticking what they're making to tax shelters. So they keep what they make. And it's the average American who's getting hit the hardest and paying an increasing larger share of the tax dollar.
Oh, by the way, speaking of tax dollars, you might be interested to know that President Carter has a gun promotion board which costs the taxpayers $400,000 a year. And you remember, Schlesinger did away with a board which is supposed to promote wind energy because that costs the taxpayers $300,000 a year.
Speaking of taxes, I just read a very interesting story in these times. Whereas Carter claims that only 23% of the federal budget goes for defense spending, that is 23% of your tax dollars actually go for defense spending. If you subtract Social Security taxes, which are really a different category of taxes, they don't come out of your personal income taxes, from 1960 to 1976, really 65% of the average American's family's federal income taxes went for military related expenditures, so that 65% of what you paid for taxes really went to the military this year, whereas Carter will tell you that only 23% of the federal budget goes for it. But since they add the Social Security in there, it gives a very misleading figures.
Good heavens. Well, we're all interested in our civil liberties, because, boy, if those go, you don't have much anything else. The American Friends Service Committee has recently published an amazing 153-page document that outlines the role of a private nationwide police intelligence network in spying on and undermining progressive organizations. It's called the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit, LEIU, and it links 225 state and local police units into a centralized computer filing system which lists all kinds of information about an unknown number of U.S. citizens. Although the LEIU is nominally set up to combat organized crime in 1956, the 13,000 pages of documents collected by the American Friends Service Committee shows that the organization is actually a very sophisticated counterintelligence network, and it compiles and spreads to other intelligence organizations information on anyone pressing for social change in the United States.
Frank, this was a fantasy of Richard Nixon's, who wanted to have centralized domestic intelligence agencies and actually set up such a thing, but was not able to institute it because of his Watergate troubles. And it looks like now the Carter administration actually supported such Nixonite counterintelligent moves.
Right. Well, this is supposed to be a private organization, but they've received many, many dollars, tax dollars, in support of their organization and operation.
Right. Well, this Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit was connected with a police unit that Nixon was setting up, so I think there's some connection there.
Well, they're not supposed to do this anymore. They've had been ordered to stop spying against political dissidents or activists, but the American Friends Service Committee documents say that the project's still going on and the computer files are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, what about the elections?
Well, yes, there's been a big election in Britain where Margaret Thatcher is the winner, so that Britain will now have two women controlling the country. And as usual, the media image on U.S. television was just stressing personalities, that Thatcher was a woman and that this created a novel situation. And the most that they said about her program was that she was anti-socialist and dedicated to cut taxes and government spending, which no doubt sounded very good to American conservatives. However, there was no details of what her programs really consisted of, or her ultra-right-wing ideology, or the more sordid aspects of her campaign. For instance, she exploited racism that this National Front right-wing organization in Britain is instigating to try to cut back on migration. They're having immigrant problems, so they think, because there is a lot of crime in England, in part because of the hard economic times, and it's blamed on immigrants, and so there's a whole tidal wave of racism, and Margaret Thatcher exploited that by calling for clampdowns on law and order, tougher police action in London against minorities, and completely stopping migration to England. Moreover, she exploited unhappiness over strikes by attacking labor unions and socialism, and carried out this whole sort of anti-socialist media blitz. But what's interesting is that no one in America on the media really analyzed what her program, her cabinet is, and what sorts of people she'll be having in her government. And as it turns out, an article by Alexander Cockburn in the Village Voice shows that it's some of the most ultra-right-wing conservatives are her advisors and will be in her cabinet. So whereas previous conservative governments in England, like Ted Heath, weren't really very much different from Labour, the current conservatives are some really terrible ultra-right wingers. For instance, they had the election in Rhodesia that we're going to report on, and who did Margaret Thatcher send as her representative to study the elections? But a certain Lloyd Boyd of Merton, who was a colonialist in the old days, who presided over the camp massacres in Kenya and was the architect of the Central African Federation. In other words, he was one of the most ultra-right-wing British colonialists. It is said that her home secretary, which is the most important domestic post, will be one William Whitelaw, who was previously Viceroy of Northern Ireland and set up the concentration camps there and is making a lot of noise about the dangers of the country being swamped by immigration and cracking down on that. Moreover, a certain Sir Joseph Keith is one of Thatcher's closest comrades in arms, who once said publicly that the poor in England were producing more babies than the rich, so that therefore the national bloodlines were being sadly diluted. More recently, Sir Joseph has been commending the superior economic relations enjoyed by South Korea, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. In other words, favoring this exporting of industry to these places that have labor markets where they can control the labor force. And in fact, the three closest economic advisors of Margaret Thatcher are devotees of Milton Friedman, the ultra-right-wing American economist, who totally believes in a free labor, a free economic markets, free enterprise market, so to speak, and advocate, quote, a Chilean solution of doing away with all state industry and returning to total private enterprise and suppressing the labor unions. Now, it's interesting that none of this was mentioned on American television, and indeed, she was championed as wanting to get rid of inefficient private enterprises, so that you saw pictures on TV of 80 women sewing in an inefficient textile factory with old machines. And they talked about the low productivity of the British industries and the needs to return them to private enterprise. What they fail to point out is that Margaret Thatcher also wants to sell profitable state industries such as British Airways, the British Cable and Wireless, and the BBC to return them to private enterprise. And she even wants to eliminate the British National Oil Corporation. So you can see what a fanatic right-winger she is. It's questionable whether she'll be able to carry through all of this program, but it certainly is a threat to whatever victories Britain has won in their social welfare state. So it's pretty sad days in England.
Well, let's take a look at Peter Bell and see what he has to say about England.
Well, England is in the news lately, and by the time you watch this segment, film with our guest Peter Bell, a visiting professor from the State University of New York at Purchase, you'll have known the outcome of the British election on May 3rd. We don't. You're ahead of us. But we'll talk about some of the background to this election, some of the crisis in England, how it'd be brought about. But before that, Peter, I grew up, I think I'm representative of most of the culture at large, and I grew up as a certain Anglophile. I still wince when Gunga Din gets it at the end of the movie. the charge of the Light Brigade, English society, it seemed all rather civil, something that we should emulate. Tell us a little bit about growing up in England and from your perspective. Demythologize some of England for us.
I grew up in England on a lot of the myths of your society. Grew up on American television serials, images of the horizons of the frontier and of Chicago as Scarface and a lot of things like that. And my conception on living here for the last 12 years, which I have, is of course substantially changed. Yes, England is not like I think many people in this country think it is. I think they have an extraordinarily romantic conception of it. I think they regard its accent as typical of its civility, its politeness. In fact, as the last 10 years in particular have shown, and some of the things we want to talk about here have shown, it's a society with considerable degrees of brutality, of social unrest, of social conflict, and of growing levels of repression inside, of social turmoil, of class struggle, of political instability, and so on. There is not, it's true, the same kind of rawness visible rawness to the society that somebody like myself who lives in Manhattan observes day by day. There's not the same kind of social rawness evident in one's day-to-day encounters with British policemen and so on, but there's nevertheless a side to England which I don't think is normally seen, and is, I don't think tourists who go to England in very large numbers from the United States would really like to see it. I think it would be very harmful to their, to what they regard very often as the cradle of their own culture and civilization.
Matter of fact, this sort of veneer of civility has been pierced just lately with the scenes of bobbies carrying off people by the necks and the outbreaks of militants on the part of your immigrant class in England just in the last few days in the news. What's behind that?
Well, first of all, historically, just for a second, I mean, some of the things that used to surprise me when I was growing up and started to read a little bit about British history, that British colonial rule was very savage, even though it was very... we taught the Indians, for example, love cricket, and they know they play cricket in the smallest villages in India, but at the same time the British cut off the hands of thousands of weavers in what is now called Bangladesh in order that they would not compete with the British cotton industry.
They actually severed
off their hands of 3,000 or 4,000.
And the opium wars, they forced opium on the unwilling Chinese.
Yes, precisely. So that while Britain spread civilization, it was not a spreading of civilization that was awfully civilized at times. And so the way that the immigrant population in Britain have now been treated, who are, of course, a product of this colonial history themselves, the largely West Indian immigrants who've migrated in, well, there are now millions of West Indians, Pakistanis, Indians, and some who lived in Kenya in England, some of whom have been drawn by higher standards of living, others have been pushed out for various reasons internal to Africa and India and so on. There are really very large problems that have emerged inside Britain, and what has become clear is that, what was always clear in my mind in many ways, is that the British are one of the most racist peoples in the world. They firmly, that their racism, I think, extends to anyone who's not English, actually. You may have, I don't know if you visited in England, Jack, but you may have encountered a certain kind of cynicism even towards Americans. A certain looking down the nose that they're not quite as cultured, that they're somehow rather vulgar. But in the case of the West Indian and Pakistani immigrants, this has reached the level of savagery in the sense that the police now are openly, rather like in the ghettos of the United States, are openly armed and policing these areas to try and maintain a hold on what is essentially a very large, cheap labor force for British industry, to try and maintain some hold over increasing levels of social unrest. There are now in Britain whole cities, industrial cities, that are virtually Asiatic or West Indian.
That is, to me, astounding. Mm-hmm. I had always the idea that it's a pretty much a lily-white population over there in England.
Yes, no, it is not. And as a consequence of this wave of immigration in the 60s, which of course occurred at the time and was welcomed at the time, as was the increased immigration in the United States in the 60s, it was in a period of economic expansion and prosperity. When that stopped, and there are millions and millions of immigrants there, they start to be seen by workers themselves as a cause of insecurity, as a cause of losing their own jobs and so on. And in Britain what has happened is that they of course stopped immigration. The Labour Party stopped immigration formally in the late 60s, stopped the free flow of people, many of whom of course have British passports, and historically they were allowed access into Britain.
Even if they're part of the Commonwealth?
They're now not allowed, no.
Even.
No, there are now two classes of passports. There are passports of people born in Britain, and there are passports of people who were born in the colonies, who have no longer any right to seek open employment in Britain.
So even white Canadians or white Australians cannot emigrate?
They can't find jobs, no. Even American students on studying abroad are not allowed legally to work in Britain, well, Canadians for that matter also.
Well, go ahead.
No, so I'm saying that the picture of Britain as a... Certainly, Jack, if you were to drive around parts of the north of England, you would think you were really visiting Pakistan. I mean, some of the factories have now organized their work schedules around Muslim religious timing so that people can pray, and they put prayer mats down in the bathrooms and maintain their religious practices during their work in the factory.
What has this done to the British labor movement and the unions? Are these people mainly non-unionized, or there's a great conflict between the old unionists and
there's a considerable amount of conflict, and part of the struggle in the last few years has been indeed to unionize some of these workers who have historically been at the lowest levels, the lowest ranks of the working class. And 2 years ago there was a strike that lasted 18 months in Grunwick, which became a cause célèbre, if you like French, of the labor movement. It was an attempt to unionize a small plant, small textile plant of Pakistanis, and establish a union in there, which they were in fact largely unsuccessful in doing so. And so that there has been some tension there, because on the one hand they take jobs in a period of unemployment, on the other hand there's been attempts of some people on the left to get them unionized. It's an incomplete process at the present time, but there's a lot of tension surrounding it, and also the fact that, as you know, in Britain there are free, essentially free social services, and so that anyone who is in Britain is has access to free public health, free education, and these are not questioned as they are here, as the repressive laws in Texas don't allow Mexican immigrants to have free access in Britain. Of course, everyone does, and so they are seen as a drain on the public purse.
Peter, let me ask you, you mentioned about the free social services. We here in America, many mistakenly equate British welfare with a socialist society. Can you explain a little bit more about the nature of British society and its welfare state and the origins of that welfare state?
Yes, well, democratic socialism in Britain essentially means free teeth. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean socialism in any fundamental sense, or any certainly any Marxist sense of the word. There is, of course, private ownership of the means of production, and Britain is essentially the distribution of wealth in Britain is hasn't changed ever since the growth of the welfare state. There are huge, very large ownings of land, of industrial capital, the Grosvenors. I'm sure you've heard of Grosvenor Square, is where the American embassy sits, and Lord Grosvenor, who's about 28 years old, just inherited several billions worth of pounds, dollars of real estate all over England, and I believe he's now investing in the United States. There's an old aristocracy, there's a new private industrial class in Britain since the Second World War. But what did emerge in Britain after the Second World War was a rather far-sighted program of public welfare. The free education and free health and the goal of full employment were articulated right after and during the Second World War, and they were brought into England, I think, ahead of most other countries in Europe. But this enlargement of the public sector, of course, has nothing to do with the private ownership of the wealth of the society. Neither, incidentally, does the occasional nationalization of key industries in Britain, which has been like a political football at times between the British Labour Party and the Conservative Party, who have alternatively nationalized and denationalized the steel industry. These are largely industries which are not doing very well. And so nationalizing them essentially buttresses the private sector, the capitalist sector. It's not a denial of that sector, but it rather strengthens it. So that the notion of socialism should not be used in the case of Britain, or for that matter in the case of Scandinavia, who largely represent, as I said, free teeth forms of public health and public education. Not that these are not things that represent extraordinary gains for the working class in these countries, they really do. And they're still very distant in the United States. Mm-hmm. So I'm not putting them down, but I'm differentiating them from any notion that this has some intellectual connection with a socialist society, which it doesn't. The Labour Party is not a socialist party. The Labour Party is a party which historically has roots through the trade union movement, but whose function has been to work for and on behalf of the capitalist system, arguing for, it is true, for less inequalities of wealth, for increased social
capitalism
services.
Capitalism with a human face.
Capitalism with a human face. But even they have had to change their tune. In fact, they have been the leaders of the movement to dismantle the welfare state. Part of the crisis in Britain is an attack on this welfare state, which grew since 45, 46 in Britain, and is now essentially being dismantled. It is being attacked left, right, and center with extraordinarily large cutbacks of social services, rather like we see in New York City.
We hear the word austerity. Actually, they were talking about austerity a lot earlier in England, were they not? with the social contract and wage freezes, the kind of things we now see in America and with the Carter administration, which the people of New York City suffered through in 74 and 75.
I think austerity is a word that the British understand more as something that they're rather used to. Ever since the Second World War, Britain did not recover like the United States and bounce forth as a leader of the world. And Britain has been an empire on the decline really for a large part of the 20th century. It's been, in many ways, psychologically had a very hard time adjusting to that role. I mean, psychologically, I don't know how you'd locate that, but in the sense that there's a depressed feeling in Britain that we're no longer great.
You're on the downswing.
On the downswing. The Second World War, of course, left Britain extremely weak, extremely devastated, and as it did much of Europe, and if it wasn't for American aid, you know, the Marshall Plan to much of Europe, of course, things would have been a lot worse. But during the Second World War, British became accustomed to rationing. In the last 10 years, they've become accustomed to shortages, to outbreaks of strikes, to services not working. They've been accustomed to what it almost amounts to, from an American perspective, would be almost a breakdown of a social system. If things did not work over here the way they do not work over there, it would be a national emergency, even for just a few days. The British, for example, have totally given up the idea of work, which is one of the fundamental fundamental aspects of the crisis, is that if you ever try and get a service, I saw a letter in the newspaper the other day saying that somebody had come to the United States. I think it was the New York Times, New York correspondent for the London Times, the economics correspondent, was saying how wonderful to come back and find that you could get repairmen to come around and fix drains and when you have frozen pipes. But in Britain that would never happen. There's no service sector that really works. If you arrive at a railway station and you want to try and find a porter, not interested in work, not interested in carrying
bags. Isn't that
bags.
Really in some ways because there doesn't exist this, a psychology of class mobility as there does in the United States about a sort of get-ahead philosophy? It's a notion that you're born into a class system and in that class system you stay. And there isn't this kind of a hustler mentality that one would find in a kind of individualist ethic like the United States.
I think that's what explains why in the United States the work ethic has had a slightly longer history than it has in Britain, although, as you know, I'm sure that in the last 10 years it has also, the work ethic has undergone a serious questioning in the United States also. But in Britain that's to some extent true. I mean, if you saw the series Upstairs, Downstairs, and you notice this deference to the upper class, I mean, when you buy a newspaper in London on the street corner, the guy will call you governor, you know? Thank you, governor, you know? As though that there's still a kind of inbred kind of feudal respect for people who are on a higher level, even people like yourself and myself who don't exactly look upper crust. I think that's to some extent that's true, but I think that there's a more fundamental question in Britain as to whether this social system can really go on. I mean, it's been now a question of touch and go, and we might want to talk about how the Labour Party in the last few years, right up to this election, was trying to hold the country together. And it's an open question as to whether the Conservatives...
Can I ask you before that, maybe following up on your notion of it sort of being a class structure and being a society that's coming apart at the seams, but there exists this mentality, this almost feudal mentality. What's the role of the sort of the crown and the pomp and ceremony of the Queen and bring as a force for social cohesion in England?
It's extraordinarily important. And not only is it a tourist attraction, but, you know, the changing of the guard and all that kind of paraphernalia, which you also find in other countries, you know, like Greece, where it has no importance whatever, the crown, really. But in Britain, it really is a fundamental importance. I mean, the working class in Britain seem to respect, for reasons that I myself find hard to understand, they respect the royal family. They love them, in fact. You know, they turn out to watch them. They take them seriously. They vote millions of dollars to retain them. And indeed, not only are they symbolic, the Queen is the richest person in England, and she is at the apex of a system of ownership of property, of wealth, and of privilege, and all the appurtenances of wealth, like fox hunting and horse racing and all the other kinds of paraphernalia that is respected, I suppose, in some levels of British society, but which provide a social cohesion in the same way that football does in the United States, you know, that brings the boss and the worker together. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, before the football game, talking about their team and their players. But it does have a very cohesive effect, and I think that I have only seen in the last few years, and I visit England frequently, I've only seen in the last few years a kind of tarnishing of that image, a questioning of it. Part of it had to do with Princess Margaret and a lot of marriages going wrong. Part of it has to do with people questioning whether they should have so much public money which is voted by Parliament and so on. But fundamentally, it's still a very important force.
Well, don't we see some of that erosion of that kind of culture in the expression of sort of the work of the Beatles and the punk rock and sort of a negation of the total culture and the meaningless of work and etc.?
Yes, they're very important aspects of the revolt in England, I think. And also, I should add, not only the Beatles, which was a late 50s, early 60s kind of working class expression of discontent, of refusal to accept the kind of hierarchy of structure, of careerism and all the rest of it. Punk rock is different again, because it shows the depth to which the society has moved away from just a kind of rebellion to an outright negation.
Complete alienation,
and the lyrics within punk rock express a fundamental rejection and nihilism of everything in the society. They also affirm a kind of working class spirit and working class integrity. And the punk rockers, of course, were kids, white working class kids, you know, who were used to factory work, used to being treated certain ways. And if you see their performances, you'll see the way they act. And they spit on stage, they swear and they cuss, as if they were doing their thing. And it was an expression, before the media and everyone caught hold of them and turned them into stars, an expression very much of this kind of thing. We should add to that list, Jack, reggae. Reggae is, of course, the West Indian, the black variation of cultural expression in Britain. And they're quite segregated. I mean, the blacks do not go to punk rock, and rather few whites go to reggae, West Indian music. They represent a kind of autonomous cultural elements. And they are challenges to this old Britain, the old Britain of upstairs, downstairs, which is still lingers a little bit.
And I imagine this ferment, this cultural ferment, is what's at least partially to explain the inability of the Labour Party to contain the workers and the agenda of austerity that has brought the capitalist system in England to the point of crisis.
Well, I think, in addition to those forms of revolt, we also have our Archie Bunkers. And as you notice, Archie Bunker is not very fond of work either. And his equivalent in the British factory is also down tools, as they say in Britain. He's also decided it's not such a, and that's the expression for, you know, knocking off, lots of terms that we use for not working. But it's not only youth revolt and blacks, it's also your ordinary worker in the factory who's decided there's not too much to be gotten out of it. And so the crisis of the last few years was really precipitated in the 60s, when the work ethic really began to reveal itself as having disappeared in Britain. Zero work was really being very practiced very, very much by British workers. The rate of profit fell in Britain. Productivity is one of the lowest in the world in Britain. And British capitalists really don't know quite what to do about this. Wage increases were so rapid that Britain had a 20% rate of inflation by the early 70s. And it was the Labour Party's role. I should explain, the Labour Party, and this will also something we should bear in mind, that the Conservative Party is now coming back into power after 5 years. They left power...
That's if they win the election.
If they win the election, which yes. Looks as though they have an edge on doing so. At the time of speaking now, a few days ahead, they have a 7% lead. It will be eroded the closer we get, so it'll be a close call. And I wouldn't want to call it, but... They lost power in 1974 at the crest of a series of industrial strikes led by the coal miners. Edward Heath, who was the Conservative Party leader, was totally unable to contain these kinds of struggles. And they were essentially forced out of power by the miners in the last analysis, by strikes that were spreading in sympathy with the miners all over the country. The Labour Party for the last 5 years has had as its historic role and its function to contain workers' wage demands, to try and turn around the low levels of productivity, to contain the wage demands, to increase productivity, and to contain the labor movement, in essence, which of course it does have, it is a part of. The trade union movement and the Labor Party are very, very integrated. They're symbiotic in a certain sense. They did so through what was called the social contract, and there are examples of that. I suppose the Carter wage price guidelines is not quite as severe, but is an approximate kind of indication of what the social contract was all about. It was an attempt to say you don't ask for wages higher than productivity. They brought down the rate of inflation to single digits in the last 5 years, but the immediate background to this...
With the help of the North Sea oil, right.
With the help of North Sea oil and a number of other favorable circumstances, but what has brought about this new election is the fact that this social contract has dissolved, and the workers are no longer abiding by the guidelines. They're no longer willing to accept low wage increases, and there are strikes all over the place. When I was in London over Christmas, and in the few weeks after I came back, just a few months ago, there were garbage strikes, truck hauler strikes, civil service strikes, hospital workers strikes, railroad strikes, all going on one after another. And it was just a tremendous sense of confusion. Through this, the Labour Party was discredited to some extent, plus the insurgent nationalism of the Welsh and the Scottish broke down the kind of majority that the Labour Party was able to have in the House of Commons. They were only in power because they had the support of what was called a Lib-Lab Pact. The Liberal Party, which is very small in Britain, was going along with the Labour Party, and so were a few Scottish nationalists. When they lost their support, they were forced to have a new election. But it's an open question whether the Conservative Party can do any better, because the reason the Labour Party was in there in the first place for these last 5 years is that they were felt do a better job to contain these problems.
So if the Conservatives or the Liberals stay in power, or the Labour Party stays in power, you look for continuing militants and, I guess, a more repressive character of the state to emerge, which we're now seeing in terms of the bobbies, as you mentioned earlier, becoming a lot more heavy-handed in their law and order.
Well, there are several things relating to this. Repression would be the solution, because I can't imagine the Conservative Party being able to contain these demands through cooperation. But repression has already been building, and there has been the growth in Britain, again, something that's not, I haven't read much about it over here, but the growth of fascism in Britain, of Nazi parties in Britain. The National Front, which is essentially a Nazi party in Britain, and which is now going round asking for an all-white Britain and kick out the immigrants, turn them back to the countries that they came from. This has led to confrontations and riots around various cities in the country where they've run candidates for election. This kind of thing suggests, plus the fact that the British have not yet dealt with Northern Ireland, but they've been using Northern Ireland as a proving ground. Dealing with the IRA and the militant factions in Northern Ireland has been rather like Vietnam was for the United States, rather like a weapons testing ground. But what has allowed the British police and the military, the army, is to develop certain techniques for crowd control, for dispersing crowds, for dismantling bombs, and so on. And when I was in London, there were constant bomb scares. They would clear Oxford Street, which is like Fifth Avenue, essentially. They would have to clear it in 2 minutes because there was a bomb threatened to be in the trunk of somebody's car. They have learned new torture techniques, and the British are quite apt at these things, you know, contrary to their civil image. I mean, they're quite apt at these kinds of techniques.
The Mau Mau can attest to that. Right?
Exactly, in Kenya. I'm glad that you mentioned that as another example of a kind of colonial history that tends to be sort of shuffled under the carpet. So that, Jack, I suspect that repression would have to be something that we would see more and more of, because I can't imagine the Conservative Party being able to pull the country together on the basis of cooperation, although what they call in Britain middle-class people, which I suppose are the more affluent kinds of workers, are thoroughly unhappy. I mean, they see the disintegration of British society, and they feel somewhat disenchanted, and they feel very depressed.
Well, this seems to me to have kind of important implications, because we here in America, interested in social change in a socialist direction, look to Britain and a lot of the Scandinavians as possible scenarios for social change. And now you're saying that essentially you can go just so far under that system, and then they pull back. Capital still has the means of production in its hand, and they go on strike, and the state then is asked to act as an instrument for repression. Do you see a kind of Chile scenario developing in England?
Not quite a Chile, but it is interesting that in the United States, more and more people talk about the United States catching what they call the English disease. Are we getting the English disease, the disease of Britain, which is this kind of malaise of the economy, the polity, the social system, and so on? I don't know that I wasn't aware quite in the way that you expressed it as being a model of direction. I suppose in the sense of the welfare state, it's a model. After all, we have Medicare and things like that now. In that sense, it's a model. In every other sense, it's a model.
But even that is being pulled back.
It is at the present time, yes. I would imagine that there would be in Britain, not a Chile, because there you have it, the social context, of course, is different. I can't imagine a Chile in Britain, but I do think that there's going to be tremendous difficulty in developing any kind of political stability in Britain over the next few years. I can imagine more fragmentation, actually, as the demands of these various sectors grow, as the demands of nationalists in Scotland and Wales and so on grow. And as the kinds of questioning of the social structure, traditional structure of Britain, accelerates and increases, I imagine the disintegration will go further.
Will it take on the character of, say, what's happening now in the repression in Germany?
Germany is a far more extreme model of what could happen in Britain, and certainly there are certain signs of it. I don't know. I think the German model, which I don't know how familiar people are with it, but is a model of extreme state repression, of citizens carrying ID cards and being subject to camera surveillance and computer surveillance and so on. That could develop, but I think there are certain differences between Britain. There's a much more, for example, a much firmer hold in Britain over civil liberties than there is in Germany.
I'd like to ask you a question, perhaps in the way of a comment also. Britain does not exist in a vacuum. It's part of the international capitalist system. And we've been watching over the months the people who speculate in foreign currencies, to a great degree, the New York banks, depressing the pound until the British government comes up with certain things which they want, or they withhold credits from the IMF or the American banks until Britain comes up with certain austerity measures. They've done it with third world countries for years. They're doing it to Turkey right now, mm-hmm. and now they're doing it to Sweden, and they've really done it to the United States. So England is in a vice, because they have to respond if they're going to maintain their capitalist system and their class and economic system the way it is. They've got to respond to these outside economic pressures, and yet on the inside there are pressures building up against the demands from these outside pressures.
Yeah, those pressures have certainly been there. The IMF imposed a series of austerity measures on Britain a few years ago, and Britain does exist in that context. I think it will continue to be forced to try and, quote, modernize itself and get itself together. Now, in this context, it has, of course, the assistance of another element, and that's the British Communist Party. That is all for modernizing British industry, for revitalizing it, and so on. And here you see, as you see in other countries in Europe, what they call Eurocommunism, which is this reformed, non-Soviet form of communism, is in fact being used as a possible alternative. The British Communist Party is all in favor of erecting tariff walls, of getting British Leyland to export more MGs and Austin motor cars all around the world, and so on. So you have internally a kind of, on the left, on the revisionist left anyway, a movement to spur this move to reform. They come hand in hand with the Conservative Party in that project. They're both economic modernizers. I don't think the international pressures that you mentioned on Britain are as severe as they were, partly because of the North Sea oil and the fact that they've been able to redress their balance of payments, and they've been able to pay back some of the loans to the IMF that they made in the last few years.
Well, Peter, thanks for coming by and spending a few minutes with us talking. When you're back in town, stop by Alternative Views.
Thank you.
Recently, there were some free, quote-unquote, elections in Rhodesia. A black man was elected to head the government. Well, what does this really mean? Were the elections really free? And why, after all these years, did they suddenly have an election? Well, we have with us Ezeyelin Agbom, who's from Nigeria, but he's from the Southern African Liberation Action Committee, and he's going to tell us something about these Rhodesian elections.
In fact, this raises an interesting question of why did they have the elections at all. For decades, Ian Smith has been maintaining a white racist regime, not allowing the blacks to vote or have any role in the government. Why was he, finally, did he concede to have elections in the first place?
Well, we got to understand the conditions that Ian Smith was put into in this last year or two. Compared to about 4 years ago, the armed struggle has intensified. Now, we got to realize that behind the racist supremacy of ideology of the ruling class in Rhodesia, which Smith represents in the National Front, is an economic base, an imperialist economic base. And when that imperialist economic base is put in threat by an armed struggle, then Smith necessarily will be forced to take positions that he has swear in public never to take. So there were pressures on him from three directions, both from the international concern, from South Africa, and specifically from the armed struggle. So the intensification of the armed struggle necessitated that Smith shift his position to allow, you know,
so that
annihilation.
He was forced to allow elections because of the militancy of the struggle, because there was such a threat to the property interest of Rhodesia that he saw that the only way he could maintain any sort of white rule was to allow elections.
Exactly.
But were they free elections and were they genuine elections? Were the blacks really allowed to have a voice in the government? It says that Musarewa succeeds Smith, but Smith is the real winner in these time stories. What does that mean?
Well, that just means that, you see, the very content of the election itself represented a constitutional arrangement between Musarewa, the now so-called elected leader, and Smith, and two other, Sotoli and another gentleman, in which a constitution was written for the transitional government. There were 100 people that were supposed to be in the parliament. 28 of them are supposed to be white, and 72 of them are supposed to be black.
This is written into the constitution.
Into the
28
constitution.
Black or 22 white.
28 white
and 72% black.
Now, but there are conditions. However, the whites are only 4% of the population. So we see here they have representative greater than their number. Apart from that, the 28 white have got a veto power.
Right. A veto power.
A veto power on anything decided by the 72 black. Not only that, they specifically in the constitution control the army, the judiciary, and the economic power. So beneath it, the economic relationship have not changed.
So they have nothing to fear. If they control all the organs of power and have veto power, whatever the blacks elect in parliament
is
and
irrelevant.
Vote on is irrelevant. So it's sort of a charade, a facade.
It's a charade of democracy. You know, we've seen this kind of thing in Africa before, in the former French colonies, and we saw it in the Congo. And there are always black people who are ready to play that kind of game. Now, I don't want to go whether it's because of personal power or because they hate violence or whatsoever.
You whether they were paid off.
Or whether they were paid off. I don't want to go into whatever drives them. The objective condition is that men like Toshumbi, men like Musarewa, place themselves against the will of the people who have been oppressed for so long they are able to identify the economic relationship. Now, this is not the kind of independence you used to have in the 60s. They are able to learn from the mistakes of other African countries who got political independence, quote-unquote, black majority rule, and found themselves subjected to economic control.
You know, we had a program a while back in which a man named Maceo Dixon had taken about a two-month trip through sub-Saharan Africa.
Oh, I saw it.
And did you see it? Okay, and he took a lot of pictures of the economic situations, the poverty and all in those various countries. And it didn't make any difference whether the government was right-wing or left-wing, black, white, or mixed. In none of those countries did the people actually have any control, basic control, over their basic economy.
This is
so it seemed like they could do the same thing in Rhodesia if they wanted to, and yet they've set up this obvious structure.
Very obvious.
Very obvious.
Very obvious. You see, foreign interest and necessitate, you know, a kind of neo-colonialist relationship with most of the African country. Now, you are talking of developing nation here, situated in a world market. I mean, there are no organs of power. Most of the things that are really necessary for you to proceed on a kind of growth that are suitable to the will of your people are being directed from outside by people who have different interests from you, which is profit for their foreign business, right?
But yet there are two liberation movements that represent, supposedly at least, the people of Rhodesia, and that is the ZANU and the ZAPU. Could you tell us some things about these two liberation organizations, what they represent, and why didn't they participate in the elections? What was their position on the elections?
Okay, these liberation movements developed out of the struggle that have been going on in Zimbabwe since 1893. In fact, the first Chiramunga War was in 1893, carried out by a combined effort of the Shona and the Ndebeles. Now, this struggle really intensified in the late 30s with the industrial and commercial unions, black unions that were smart. And in the 50s, there were great civil unrest in Rhodesia. I mean, marches for African rights, marches for demonstrations, marches in demonstration, agitating that, you know, independence should be given to Zimbabwe like other African countries. Now, between the 60s and 1965, the British did play a very dirty game. They were not interested in handing over power in Rhodesia because they're, you know, very interested, very important minerals in there. So in 1965, Ian Smith took over power. And according to the British Constitution, he's supposed to be a rebel. There was UDI, Unilateral Declaration of Independence. Now, having utilized all resources, because between 1957 and 1965, ZAPU, which is Zimbabwe African People's Union, was lobbying in Congress with the British, everything you could think of that was legal. And ZANU, which was formed in 1963 from ZAPU, was also at first interested in using non-violent means. Now, the repressive apparatus of Smith's government, of the white minority, left no alternative but for an armed struggle.
So the two groups tried to get some concessions from Britain at the time of independence granted to Rhodesia, but the British and the Rhodesians refused to allow them to have any concessions, so that they were forced to take up armed struggle just to fight for their basic rights.
I have to say one thing. You see, Rhodesia was never independent. Rhodesia was a British colony.
Mm-hmm.
Ian Smith declared it independent.
Mm-hmm.
And he declared it independence without any right for blacks.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, 4% of the whites owning all the mines, all the sources of economic power, 50% of the land, which means the best land, controlling the police, the army, and what you were talking, the organs of power, and setting themselves in the image of South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Laws after laws. And not only that, they were smashing these movements that were using what people call legitimate means, which is questionable, to try and achieve, you know, what African legitimate right.
Well, what? Why didn't they vote in the elections? They didn't they participate, the ZANU and the ZAPU, the liberation
movements? This is because,
movements.
Like I've explained, an election is a process,
mm-hmm.
okay, a process that is supposed to signify democracy. Now, democracy is just a word. Within that word democracy, there is a content, a certain social relationship that it represents, which I've just described by telling you how the powers are going to be represented in this constitution, in this parliament. So they were quite aware it was a charade.
Mm-hmm.
As you well know, Smith himself, you know, was not ready to do it. So, you know, I mean, they didn't want to have anything to do with it. They knew what it represented, and so they didn't participate.
What is their strategy and political program then? What do they propose?
Okay.
In order to liberate Rhodesia?
What they propose is this, that the wealth of Zimbabwe, how it should be used, will be decided by the people of Zimbabwe, all the people. Because you see, the confrontation in Zimbabwe is not just a question of white and black, it's a question also of oppressed and oppressor. So now they take a position that despite your race, as a Zimbabwe nationality, you will participate in the distribution and in the share of the wealth of Zimbabwe, and that the wealth of Zimbabwe shall be controlled by the people of Zimbabwe. Now, both of them go for a very democratic state.
First of all, the word Zimbabwe is the term that they use for the territory and not Rhodesia. What does Zimbabwe signify? Is it an African tribal name or?
No, it is, I think it is the Shona, I'm not sure of this, Shona dialect for the land of the people.
The land of the people.
Yeah, Rhodesia is after Civil Road, that imperialist people call it philanthropic today. I mean, he was responsible for the colonization of Zimbabwe. And, you know, like, right now, anyway, the Patriotic Front, which is the alliance between ZAPU and ZANU, are winning the armed struggle, as you can see with all the interest by international concern, and Smith changing strategy every now and then.
Will it continue, the armed struggle of the two liberation movements?
Yeah. The controlling ZANU's slogan says, we are on, the Zimbabwe people are their own liberation. liberators. And the armed struggle will continue until the total liberation of Zimbabwe. And right now, they control 3/4 of the country. In fact, there are reports, not by them, but by visitors into Zimbabwe, that, you know, there are freedom fighters are able to walk around in towns without being stopped now. Even Muzorewa himself agreed the economy is breaking down, everything is breaking down. So there's something I want to talk about. There are other people interested in this, as you well know, the British, the United States, South Africa. Now, South Africa has set up a strategy of enclosing itself with buffer zone, buffer states. With the defeat of Angola and Mozambique, South African strategy has gone like this. You carry out an internal election in Namibia, you carry out an internal election in Zimbabwe, you get some black faces, you put them there, and you support them with military power. So right now, South Africans have come out and told Muzorewa that they are ready at any time to supply him with all the military force he requires, and that they are going to put their boundary of defense on the boundaries, on the northern boundaries of Zimbabwe.
So this could be a very hot war between South Africa and the current Rhodesian government against the liberation movement. So this might be a major international explosion in the weeks to come, and it will be interesting to see the role of Britain and America on this, if they support the Rhodesian South African government. This is why the Rhodesian government is so concerned, is it not, to get popular support for its government, to try to ensure, to assure the world that it is a democracy, so they can get support for military adventures against the National Front. Is that correct?
Against the Patriotic Front. That is right.
And also to get the economic embargo lifted.
Lifted up.
Which is not lifted completely.
That's right. So,
well, we appreciate you coming by and giving us this information about Rhodesia, giving us some additional insight. And as things develop in that country and other parts of the world there, we hope you come by and fill us in on that, too.
I don't know. Let me just say one thing.
Okay, sure.
There are many support groups in America. Mm-hmm. And in about 145 universities in America, there are certain African support groups, people who devote their time to really spreading the objective condition that exists within Zimbabwe and what is really going on there. I mean, getting the right kind of information out to people, because the information here is really limited, and
yes,
people who give material support to the armed struggle. So, you know, like all over American university, there are community groups and there are churches, in fact, that are involved, as you well know, in the Southern African struggle. The Council of Churches.
Mm-hmm.
I recently gave some funds to the Patriotic Front.
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain relationships here that goes beyond the normal kind of... For those people who really know what is going on, even for the churches have come out, you know, giving aid not only to the refugees, but, you know, in support of the Patriotic Front.
Well, this is precisely what we're trying to do here, is to give information to the people so that they can be informed as to what's going on in Africa. And we will continue to cover this very unknown continent for the American people in the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, we have a quick bedtime story here. Coca-Cola, which is even quicker, I guess, because Coca-Cola looks like it's going to be the big loser in one of its own contests. Made a whole lot of fanfare a while back, about a month ago, actually. The soft drink company started a big supermarket game. Match One, Win One was the name of it. It was designed to promote sales of the company's diet drinks, and it gave customers a chance to win prizes with each purchase of a carton of Tab Fresco or sugar-free Sprite or some kind of rot. Well, anyway, last week, Coke quietly suspended the game. It appeared that more customers were winning than they had planned. We don't know what happened, a spokesman said from Coke. It appears possible that more winning coupons inadvertently were printed, much more than we expected.
So much for private enterprise.
So much, yeah, for free funds and game. Good night.
Good night.